What's up, bros? Siege here. Just giving you guys a little heads up before the episode. This was recorded before the new wave of resistance and protests, but we still want to make sure that our voices are heard and that it is known that we support and we encourage our listeners. Follow the Black Lives Matter movement. Visit blacklivesmatter.com to learn how to donate, sign petitions, and protest safely. You can also check out Black Visions Collective, Reclaim the Block, Know Your Rights Camp, Minnesota Freedom Fund, Communities United Against Police Brutality, and the ACLU to learn more about the cause. Defund the police, Black Lives Matter, and enjoy the episode. When this ball meets love.
What up, bros? What up, bros?
And welcome to Bro Meets World.
What is Bro Meets World?
Your Boy Meets World fan cast. This is episode 83. I'm Siege.
I am your boy, Tony Curtis. How are you guys?
I was going to ask you, how are you? I have been editing a lot of our season one episodes, and I was just listening to our little intros. They're like, we used to have like such conversations, and now we just dive on in. So,
well, I, you know, can I speculate as to why?
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, 2020 has been an emotional, wreckage
of a year.
And I have been looking forward to our conversations as an escapism, as a way to get away from the terrible news that seems to pop up week by week. And also, I'm in quarantine. Not much is going on.
Exactly. You know what? I will allow that. That sounds like very much in line of what's going on. It's like, if I were to ask you, hey, how are you doing? You're like, oh, the world's on fire. What else is new?
Yes, the world's on fire and I'm still at home.
Okay, so that being said, we do have new news in the Boy Meets World fandom. Danielle Fischel responded to Trina McGee's claims. Basically, she just notified the public of an apology. Apparently,
hey, Siege, for those who don't know what you're talking about, can you give them some background info on the Trina McGee scandal and the Boy Meets World verse?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. So not too long ago, earlier in the season, we talked about the fact that Trina McGee, who plays Angela in the next season of Boy Meets World fame, and she's also the one who ends up dating Sean and is just becomes a staple of the Boy Meets World lore, she released a statement saying that three of the main cast members, which was narrowed down to Ben Savage, Danielle Fischel, and Will Friedle, basically teased her and did several either racist comments or microaggressions while she was filming. And it was this whole situation about the production of Boy Meets World and even the reboot Girl Meets World and her treatment there. And Danielle Fischel recently commented on it, saying that she called Trina McGee and basically apologized, and it was accepted, and Trina McGee backed that claim. So far, that's two out of the three. We still haven't heard anything from Ben Savage, but
yeah, which is disappointing.
Honestly, I'm not gonna lie, I love this show, but the more I see like the live, I'll say, what are they called? Kind of like panels, conventions, all this other stuff. Ben Savage seems like removed from like socializing. Like, I don't really know how to say it any other way than everyone else seems to have like this energy and this vibe with each other. And he seems part of it, but like on the edges. Like, he's there, but like not really in.
I have noticed this as well, and it's part of the reason why I often get a little disappointed and sometimes bored when I'm watching these panels, because there's so much that, like, I don't know. I can't imagine what it's like to have the most famous thing you did be from 20 years ago, like, and having to talk about it all the time. Like, I can't imagine how annoying that must be. But if you sign up to do a convention or a panel, like, you're going to be with people who are diehard fans, with nerds for your art that you produce in the world. Like, you can get a little bit more excited about it, Ben. Like, he doesn't chime in for questions unless he's directly asked. He just seems, like you said, removed, detached. I don't know if it's an ego thing, but it comes across more like laziness.
Honestly, I don't think it is. I think that, like, it's really funny because when I look at these panels and I see how Daniel Fischel and Will Friedle interact with Ben Savage themselves, it just seems like that's him. Like, I think there was like a whole story of they were all like telling stories back and forth about what they used to do. And Ben Savage was like thinking about Raisin Bran. You know, like, he was like, that's just who he is. He's just like, he is that celery poster on the wall that he becomes famous for. And that's, again, that's nothing against him, but that's who he is and that's his personality.
I wonder if he is just, you know, naturally when the cameras are off, not very expressive or, you know, kind of shy.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
All that plays into him not reaching out to Trina McGee for anything. But I have to say, like, all of this is super disappointing as a Boy Meets World fan, like, to hear that, you know, the one Black cast member that had any, you know, longevity on the show was ostracized, was, you know, whether it be microaggressions or anything more, you know, overt, experienced racism on the show that played such a huge part in my childhood. It's disappointing to hear. And I'm glad that they're working it out now. And I'm glad that, you know, much like a lot of people in 2020, they're reflecting and having these hard conversations. But it's also like, dude, like, she was on Girl Meets World. Like, this was recently. Like, it wasn't like it was from the 90s.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I mean, we talked about it when we did our episode, I Ain't Your Aunt Jemima, which basically talked about this in full. But when I really do think about the way that they wrote her character, even like the idea of her character needing to come to Sean for approval to get married is like so backwards from what we see or what we will see with their dynamic in general, let alone any Black woman you would know, you know, in person. It's just, it was a very weird and weirdly handled situation. And I think that as with all things we are revisiting, we can only hope to do better.
You know, it's funny. Our production company that we have for our podcast is called Two Free Tokens, and based on the fact that we're often the token Black people in a group of white faces. And I have to, you know, reflect on our experiences that we had with all white friends and how much accidental racism slipped out when you were just around a group of white people whose privileges weren't being checked. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine that on a Hollywood level when people have more of a freedom with fame to maybe be a little bit more outspoken, what that was like for her on set when you're not only surrounded by all white faces, but these are white faces that are constantly getting adoration, constantly getting attention and accolades, what it must have been like for her, regardless, again, of how overt the racism was.
Absolutely. And we also talked about the fact that they were actual children when I believe she was a little bit older when she started to play the Angela character. So there is that like age gap that, again, is never an excuse, but definitely a explanation.
You know, there was a huge age gap between on Saved by the Bell, between Screech and the rest of the cast. Mm-hmm. And there was also a lot of like relationship issues between Screech and the rest of the cast because he didn't feel like he was seen as a peer, because he was seen as something different, because he wasn't in their age group. And I just wonder if that's just a thing that happens on shows sometimes, that there are just certain age groups that just kind of click up. And, you know, when you have a show like Boy Meets World where the central cast is clicked up, you know, how that could make guest stars or you know, people who are not the main cast feel when they're on that set, on that environment where they're not feeling supported.
So you just made me think, and I do wonder what Lark Voorhees, like, what was her experience like being like the only Black person? I mean, she did have AC Slater to be with her in the cast, but Mario Lopez has shown himself to be a little bit of a situation himself. So I don't think we were exactly riding with him the whole way.
I do not want to talk about Mario Lopez because if I get started, it's all I'm going to talk about.
Okay, well, before we detour too far, get it? Get my segue? Detour, driving.
I like it.
We will introduce this week's episode, which is season 4, episode 14, Wheels.
Yeah.
You want to do your tummy about it, Lil Swan?
Oh, of course. Yeah. As everyone knows, I try to incorporate Billy Joel's Tell Me About It to use to sum up the episode. Here we go. Tell me about it. Tell me all about the show. Corey gets stopped by cops. Surprisingly, he is not shot.
Thank you. And this is exactly what I wanted to talk about. Because when we were talking about detours, I was like, the way this show and this episode handles the police is very much about privilege. And so I'm really excited to get into it.
Totally. Yeah, let's get into that. Tell me about it.
Yeah, this is season 4, episode 14, Wheels. Alan finds himself at a crossroads when Corey, armed with a new driver's license on his 16th birthday, would rather celebrate the event on a road trip with Sean and Topanga instead of with his father. Meanwhile, on their road trip, Corey gets stopped by the police and goes to trial while his dad watches videos of Corey when Corey was a little kid.
I'm gonna go out on the limb before I even begin this episode, diving into it, and just say, I like this episode. I have so many problems with every part of it.
I agree with you. I was like, this was another one of the memorable episodes that we always talk about. I'm also laughing because I mentioned earlier that I'm editing these episodes. And I don't know how many times we said the words, this is when it really begins, Boy Meets World.
Yeah.
But like, this is just like definitely one of those more iconic episodes. And I rewatching it, I was like, oh, I have a lot of problems with what's going on. So let's just get into it. First thoughts.
First thought is that someone saying, I want to drive 2 hours to see a movie is immediately a lie to me. There's no excuse. This is about 16-year-olds going to see an R-rated Van Damme movie. Can 16-year-olds even get into an R-rated movie?
No, which is what Alan was like talking about. He's like, you can't even get in. You have to be 17 or older. But they were just going to sneak into the movie because they're that old now. They can just sneak in.
In all fairness, I used to sneak into R-rated movies all the time. Hey, kids, listen up. This is the easiest way to do it. When you want to go see Van Damme rips out throat of Asian man playing in Auditorium 3, you actually get tickets to, let's say, Little Women playing in Auditorium 2 that starts half an hour beforehand. You sneak right in. It works every time.
So what's really funny is I was very much like a Corey in the sense of like I was too much of a goody-goody and I was like, we'll always get caught. And I had several friends constantly try to get me to sneak into theaters, but I was so obvious about it that we would always get caught because I would be like, can we do this? Like, are they going to catch us? And they were like, what's this giant big kid doing?
Sometimes it backfires. Sometimes like our local movie theater got hip to it and started putting like little cops outside of the R-rated movies to check your tickets. And I got stuck watching Jackie Chan The Tuxedo, which is maybe notorious, the worst movie I've ever seen in my life. Say,
notoriously one of the worst movies. So that was definitely a punishment in itself.
That was a punishment. I learned my lesson.
So. Also, this is like completely me being a little geeky, but while watching the episode, I was like, what Van Damme movie could they be going to see? All my research, considering the fact that this episode came out in January of 97, the newest R-rated Van Damme movie was Maximum Risk, which came out in September of 1996. So
I'm embarrassed to say that I am a little too familiar with Jean-Claude Van Damme's filmography, and I don't recognize that title whatsoever.
So I have no idea what it's about. It is not rated high, but if you want to see the movie that Corey was really willing to risk jail time for, it is Maximum Risk.
Yo, what did you think about Topanga like being down to do it because she gets to see Van Damme with his shirt off?
I feel like, again, we're dealing with this point of time in Topanga where she's half teenage girl and I allow her that freedom. And then other times it's just like the writers are just writing what they think a teenage girl would do. But I do feel like that's kind of true to Topanga, especially like a little bit later in the episode when she's like, look, the responsible part of me doesn't think that we should be doing this, but the other part of me really wants to go. Thank you for listening to me. just thank you for helping me process this.
No, I actually think Topanga's pretty, I like her in this episode overall. My main issue is Alan in this episode.
Yes. Well, to be fair, it's Alan and Corey, but Alan should know better. Because
Alan is a birthday ruiner. He ruined Eric's 18th birthday. He's ruined Corey's 16th birthday by some, like, the reason Alan gets mad at Corey is ridiculous to me because Alan is furious that Corey goes to get his license with Sean and Topanga on his birthday, even though Alan never said, hey, Corey, I really want to go with you and go get breakfast. That's what I did with Eric. The problem is that we saw It's a Wonderful Night, the episode where Eric gets his license. And yep. He goes on his birthday with Jason.
Yep.
Of course, he fails. And of course, he has a whole situation that follows. But if Alan did go with Eric to get his license, he did not go on Eric's birthday. And he did not make Eric feel any pressure to have breakfast with him and go with him. So this whole episode just felt like a real, like, wait, what?
Yeah, well, also, it's the idea of communication. Most of this is communication and just male stubbornness. And the idea that he would have all of these plans for a 16-year-old without, like, they had a dinner planned and didn't tell Corey. And it's like, I don't know a lot of things, but I do know that teenagers have plans and they have friends. And why does his friends not know about this dinner that's coming on tonight? You know what I mean? It's like They made all of these plans and they didn't really even run it by. And I love that Amy was like, does Corey know anything about this? Because it's a perfect example of, in general, I hate surprises because you don't know what I have planned. And I feel like Corey is justified in his anger about the situation, even though he's not justified with his actions.
I thought Alan was kind of a little bitch.
He was.
The whole episode. I was totally on Corey's side for the first half of it. And, you know, once we get to like the actual car cop scenario, that's where the episode kind of takes a turn for me. But throughout the first half of it, I just couldn't stop feeling like Alan was just ruining his son's birthday for his own reasons. And obviously, you know, the show makes it seem sentimental that Alan just misses his little boy. But if he misses his little boy, he would make sure he had a better birthday.
Absolutely. Well, I think what's important to notice is this is a habit of Alan's. As you pointed out, it's the same thing with Kid Gloves episode where he gives Corey this gift that he doesn't – like, Alan has all of these grand ideas in his head, but he doesn't really communicate them to anyone. He just kind of does things and expect people to fall in line. And that's not how anything should happen. Like, if you're doing that, you are setting yourself up for disappointment and you're setting other people up to like feel embarrassed or feel like they haven't lived up to some ideal that they had no agreement to.
I want to quickly mention this because you brought up Kid Gloves, the episode in season one where Alan gives Corey his boxing gloves that he won in the Navy for, you know, I guess the silver gloves. There's a point where Corey's trying to find ways for Morgan to relate to Alan, and Morgan's like boxing and gives him a mean hook, like left hook right to the face. And I'm like, Corey, that's your in. Like, she can box. Alan's a boxer. Like, make this happen. What's really funny too is that Morgan calls the boxing gloves boxing mittens, which is also how Corey referred to them when he got the silver gloves from his dad in that season one episode.
Absolutely. And I think you're right. I didn't think about that, but why not? Like, again, I think it's this narrow-mindedness of Corey trying to make Morgan into a boy instead of just looking at the talents that she's already showing and being like, hey, you and dad have this in common. Why don't you bond over it? And I think that what the episode does is it shows us that Alan is this way because Corey's his youngest son and Morgan's his first daughter instead of his third son. And Alan just basically is having a midlife crisis again because Corey's getting older and he won't get a chance to do all of these things. But very much like we say in any other episode or with any other situation, you can't put those feelings and that feeling of inadequacy on anyone else. Like, your behavior towards everyone else in that situation is uncalled for. That is a personal gripe, and you don't get a pass because your son is getting older.
It's so interesting how this show, this specific episode, plays with like gender bias in parenting, which I think is something that you were kind of touching on, like how Alan's feeling about his last son versus, you know, the fact that Corey's a middle child, and just this idea of like, well, you know, Morgan's around, but she's just a girl. It just feels kind of dismissive and kind of shitty to just feel like, well, I mean, Morgan's a girl, so there's no chance that he can have a relationship with his daughter. I mean, why would any man have a relationship with his daughter? Like, it's ridiculous, right?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, even when it comes to the fact that he was like, hey, Morgan, do you want me to go do your hair? And she's like, are you kidding me? And he's like, you're right. But it's like, why did you try to do something that you would have never done, i.e. her hair? Why not ask what her interests are or do whatever Morgan would want to do, but not impose yourself in the situation that you don't belong?
One of my least favorite traits of early 90s movies and kid-based movies and television shows was this idea that like parents hated doing what kids wanted to do. Like, it was like annoying to like take a kid to do something like a show or that he wants to go to, or, you know, to a circus or a play, like anything like that. Like, it always seemed like a frustration or a burden to parents to invest in what the kid's interested in versus the parent like trying to bring the kid in what they're interested in. Like, oh, come hear this band that I used to listen to in the 60s, or come watch this sports game that's really important to me. Like, it's something I've noticed among many television shows and movies in the 90s, and I wish I had more examples to give. The one I'm kind of thinking of is Getting Even with Dad with Macaulay Culkin.
That's exactly what I was thinking of.
But just this idea that just like, wow, like, why not just do something that the kid's interested in to relate to them and build a relationship that way versus it being the other way around? I don't know, what was it about that generation of parenting in the 90s that felt like the only way to get a kid in is to pull them into your realm of interest?
Well, so a little context, what we're dealing with in the 90s is this first real generation of dads who are separated from their children. You know, like, it's kind of like a norm now that all these dads are divorced. And like, we see it a lot in the Santa Claus and a lot of these movies where like it used to be like the twist was, and dad takes care of the kids. But now it's like, and dad takes care of the kids while having his own job, and dad has to experience what it's like to be a single parent for the first time. So that's really what we were dealing with. We were dealing with all of these, I'll say, Hollywood execs who were telling stories about, hey, did you know that bonding with your kid is harder than it seemed? And here are a few ways. So
that's super interesting how you're talking, how you made the connection between just like the family shift that took place in the 80s and 90s of increasing divorce and different kinds of households, you know, whether it be that the dad is divorced or the fact that the mother would be working, leaving more responsibilities to parenting to fall on the dad, like how that made its way into our art that we consumed. Fascinating, bro.
Yeah, well, you get a lot of movies at that time that are just about dads learning to value their families.
To not be shitty dads. That's the whole plot.
Exactly. That's really it. And a lot of them fail at it, but the whole arc is supposed to be, you know, this big businessman has to take care of his kids for a weekend. What's he going to do with them? So yeah, I think
did you ever see Mr. Mom with Michael Keaton?
I never saw Mr. Mom, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Maybe we'll do that for Movie Makeover, because that's some exactly what the hell we're talking about. Like, the whole premise is like, hey, you have to do what your wife has been successfully doing for years.
Exactly. Well, there's like, you get Getting Even with Dad. There's the one where it was like Chevy Chase and JTT.
Yes, Man of the House.
Yes, thank you. There's one where it's
rest in peace, Farrah Fawcett.
Ted Danson and Macaulay Culkin, I believe. Like, I don't know. Like look at it. Anyone who's listening to us right now, go and look up. There's just a slew of kids' movies where the whole premise of the movie is kid is with dad for the weekend. Or, you know, for however many weeks because mom is out of the picture. So, anyway, getting back to our episode, I think that what we're trying to say is every character in here is responsible for their own feelings and behavior, and acting out does not excuse you. I think Alan's behavior is, like I said, it's shown a pattern throughout the many episodes that we've seen of him just kind of assuming that everyone will fall in line and getting upset when they don't. And I think that that's something that modern television would explore, at least call out.
Totally. Totally.
Let's talk about Corey in this episode, and his kind of assumptions. Cause we open up with Corey being like, of course my dad's going to give me the car. Why would he not? You know what I mean?
I think that Corey, again, he is treating his relationship with his dad like it's continuously always been. Like, you know, I've had a driver's permit and dad's let me take the car and he hasn't made a big deal about it. And so I don't see why he wouldn't do this for me for my birthday. Like, I am in your court, Corey. Why wouldn't he give you the car? It's your birthday. Like, go to the damn movies.
Oh, I will say that we kind of skipped over this, but when Alan finds out that Corey has already gotten his license and he throws his little hissy fit and Corey's like, well, can I have the keys? The moment Alan's like, well, actually I have some, well, no, what he says first is, sure, I wouldn't mind being driven around. And Corey's like, that's not what I meant. And then he gets really upset and he's like, well, I have some things I need to do. So let me be gone for a few hours and then get back to you. And again, at this point in time, he also hasn't mentioned the dinner.
Now, did Corey say that he waited for like 5 hours for Alan to come home? Like, Alan literally had the day off on his son's birthday and was like, I'm going to decide to use this time to run errands that require the car.
Exactly. That's so petty. It's so petty. So petty and childish.
Oh, my God. I will have to say that, again, like, Corey's initial motivation of just like, hey, I want to drive to Atlantic City to go to the movies feels like a lie to me. One, because I'm from Atlantic City. I was born there. I have family there. I know what Atlantic City has to offer. People do not go there for movies. also, again, this is getting real into the depths of it, but being from Atlantic City, I know that the drive to Philly is an hour and a half on the Atlantic City Expressway. Unless this dude was trying to avoid tolls, there ain't no reason for him to be on the back road. I don't know where this mysterious country town is in New Jersey, but again, there's several highways that will get you to Atlantic City very quickly.
Yeah, I looked it up and I was like, it's an hour and a half drive. Where was Corey going? But maybe he was going too slow for the highway because we saw how slow he was getting.
Him driving like an old man doesn't surprise me at all. Like, not that at all. Feels right in line with Corey's character.
Very much so.
So he gets a ticket.
Before we go there, I want to talk about the dinner and just Corey and Alan's tension in this episode, because I think you're right. There is Corey is rightfully upset, but just the way that he talks to for me, it's hard because I remember what I was like when I was 16, and there were plenty of yelling and conversations because it just feels like an injustice. And so you are angry and you are loud, but it also does kind of seem like he's putting in zero effort even at his dinner. You know, like, they're already talking about, can we go? And, like, it's like, how hard would it be to have some cake, put on a smile, and then ask for the keys?
Also, when I'm a teenager, I don't know about you, if someone else is paying for my dinner, I'm there.
Yeah, I was like, he didn't know about the cake again.
He didn't know about his second clown burger. He got two clown burgers, bro. Like, it's a good day.
Exactly. There was just such opportunity for it to be a good day. And I feel like Corey kind of ate it to it with his attitude. But also, like, as a teenager, being 16, to have, like, your entire day ruined by your dad, who is just being petty and childish, I can imagine tensions would remain high.
I really like episodes when there's tension between Alan and his children. I feel like it's far too television fantasy-like for there to be this, like, completely cohesive relationship between the parents and the kids, especially the fathers and the kids. Like, I feel like every person I know or talk to, even people who have great relationships with their fathers, are like, yeah, me and my dad have gotten into it a few times. And it's fatherly tension is just, I feel like, a very American thing. Again, I don't know whether it's because of the generational gaps where there's not a lot of emotion expression, but for example, like, me and my fiance have been trying to do our family trees recently. Mm-hmm. And so we've been reaching out to our parents to talk about it. Our dads don't know anything about the family history and they don't want to talk about it. It's like, they just do not want to, like, express things like that. And I think that's just what's taught to them about, like, hey, you just work hard and you focus on that and you don't worry about the past and emotions and feelings. And so, I feel like it's a very realistic thing for there to be tension between Alan and his kids, because it's more of a reflection of teenage life, I feel. And even though I don't agree that, like, this was the best conflict for them to have, because Alan is painted to be a little bitch, I do enjoy that there is some more realism between their characters as father and son.
Yeah, I completely agree. What do you think about, like, the other characters in this episode, such as Alan, Amy, Eric, and Topanga?
I love Amy.
I love Amy. Don't get me wrong. I always love Amy, and she usually is the most reasonable person in the room. But I was just kind of upset that she didn't have more of, like, she's taking this approach of, like, seeing the tension and seeing what's going on, but not really participating. And maybe that's just my habit of, like, wanting to get involved and solve things. But Amy's really kind of, like, taking a step back, and she's just watching it.
I don't know, dude. Okay. Here's why I am kind of cool with that, because I am thinking about this from, like, a parenting thing. Like, I'm co-parenting, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you and your boyfriend have a kid, you guys are going to be co-parenting together. And so you would want to make sure that you're constantly on the same page when it comes to your kids. I always thought that, like, with my life partner that I have kids with, like, I would want to make sure that, like, we don't talk down to each other when we're around the kids. We don't, you know, go against each other. Like, I always want to be, like, a united front with the kids. So the idea that Amy's like, you know what, I'm going to wait and talk to him about this later, I kind of respect that. Do I wish that she had a little bit more agency in the relationship, where it didn't feel like she was, as a parent, like, checking in on him, but more as a partner, like, saying, hey, I have a 50% say and I feel this way? Of course. But I do respect the fact that she didn't undermine her partner in front of their kids.
Yeah, I guess that's we're practicing that with the puppy right now. And let's just say it has not always gone off as easily.
Yeah.
Lots of times. But you're right. There are moments where I'm like, this isn't what we agreed upon, or this isn't what I would prefer. But because what we're trying, the most important thing to do right now is to get control of the situation, I'll just be quiet and see where things go. So I guess I can see that. I was just like, I always want more of Amy, and she was just, again, the supportive spouse instead of, like, a real, like, force in the episode.
Totally. I think that Sean and Topanga are used perfectly in this episode. I think they're in it for just the amount of the right time. I think they bring the right energy to it. Like, you know, Sean and Topanga are kind of always the angel and devil on Corey's shoulder. And I feel like, you know, even in this situation where Topanga is, you know, the wiser one, you know, she admits that she has immature tendencies. So when they are on the hot highway going towards Atlantic City and they get pulled over, it's not like, it's not unexpected that they would run into error.
I love what you were saying, because the narrative of Sean and Topanga always being the devil and angel on Corey's shoulder, that's so it. Like, you're right. It's like, Sean's always like, what? Why don't you have the keys? Why aren't we going on this road trip? What's, you know, like he's always like pushing. And Topanga really does kind of take a step back and just, she's like, hey, I want to be there as well, but, like, let's try to be responsible in what we're doing. She's the one who says during the dinner, can't we at least pretend to be having a good time?
Yeah. And she's also the first one that's like, hey, maybe you should call your dad.
Yeah, exactly. And also, but I think it's great that they're there and they're letting Corey solve his own issues, because they understand that this isn't something they can force him to do. This is just kind of like watching your friend, yell at their parents and you're like, this has nothing to do with me. I wouldn't do it. Not in my house, but, you know.
For it being such an awkward day, like the fact that Sean and Topanga were like, hey, it's still your birthday. Like, we're still here with you. Whatever you want to do, we're down for. I thought that was cool. I don't know how much Eric really played in the episode. I don't really remember him much, except for him singing happy birthday when he was bringing out the car cake.
Well, he's the one who says, he's the one who gives Corey some context into what's going on. Of course, he does so in a very teasing way when he's like, dad liked me better. And so, you know, like I had an easier time. But he is kind of there as the brotherly support during this episode.
And yeah, because he's the one who says the reason why dad's upset is because you're his second, Morgan's his third daughter, not his third son.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he does kind of school him a little bit. Yeah, so he acts as the older brother who gives him insight. Everyone fulfills their roles pretty well there, as far as like Eric, Sean, and Topanga go.
Yeah, and now we can talk about the part where Corey gets pulled over, going 1 mile over the speed limit, because it's a speed trap. And I thought that this was very interesting, considering everything we're talking about with defund the police and abolish the police and basically just the entire system. Because I have so many questions here.
But before what cop pulls you into a courthouse at night for an immediate trial based on the opinion of one judge?
Exactly.
That seems like some unconstitutional bullshit.
Thank you. But while we're doing that, I want to do our roll call where we can talk about the individuals. So we get Dan Loria, who is Judge Lamb.
Fucking love him.
He also everything. Played the dad in The Wonder Years, which stars Ben Savage's brother.
Fred Savage.
Fred. I was like, it's not Ed Savage. I was like, what?
Ed Savage, yeah. No, Ed Savage hasn't had an acting career. He's the other Savage brother. But no, Fred Savage stars in The Wonder Years, and Dan Loria is his dad on that show. And I always kind of consider The Wonder Years the prequel show for Boy Meets World.
Very much so.
For him being there and also being a father figure, even in this role as a judge, I thought was very fitting for him.
Absolutely. And then Raymond O'Connor plays Officer Dibble.
No thoughts on him.
He's a stock character, so.
Yes.
But he is the one who's constantly, I will say, the thing with Officer Dibble is he's always like, it's a speech. What part are you not getting? And I think that, at least for me, that was very transparent of like, dude, this is made to trip you up. And there's like, throw all your logic out of the window, because the question is, did you break the law? Yes or no? And for all of you people who argue, if you don't want to do the crime, if you don't want to do the time, don't do the crime. This is the bullshit that people of color put up with all the time.
I wrote that the cops treat Corey like a black kid, in the sense that he gets pulled over for going 1 mile above the speed limit, is immediately sentenced to see a judge, and he doesn't get a lawyer to represent him. I was just like, wow, I can't believe they're treating Corey so black in this episode.
Yeah, I love it. Like, he doesn't, like, not only that, what I thought was really interesting is this system of him not being able to even get, like, they're like, hey, we can pay the bail if you can tell me where the nearest ATM is. It's like, there is no ATM. We don't accept credit cards. It has to be cash, and it has to be now. I was like, this is a messed up system that is specifically made in Jersey to put people in prison. You know what I mean?
Yeah, New Jersey, get your shit together.
Yeah, I was like,
we know you're out there on those streets pulling over those innocent white kids for driving 1 mile over, and we've had enough. Oh my goodness. Okay, I do have to say, as much as I had an issue with the whole concept of a speed trap, while watching the episode, I was like, this is such a dumb thing to like get these kids into a court setting. Like, it just felt like a stupid excuse. I love how it's used in the story to demonstrate how childhood is a speed trap. And for Alan, you know, Dan Loria says something to Alan after he gets called. I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead. But
you're fine.
The whole concept of just like, you know, these kids grow up so fast, it's a speed trap, helped bring the episode around and helped me appreciate the use of that tool to tell the story more than I did when I was first introduced to it.
Absolutely. I agree. That was one of the things that I pulled. This idea that Judge Lamb is telling not only Alan, who is really important to get considering that Alan is pining over his son growing up, but also to Corey. He's like, look, I know that when you're 16 and you have a license, those 2 years seem like forever, but you just don't know how fast they go by. And Alan, the exact same thing. He's like, you need to understand that he's under your roof for 2 more years and you'll blink and that'll be gone. So you guys need to really put this tension aside, because your time together as a family unit is coming to an end.
For Dan Loria to be the one who says to Alan, like, hey, before you know it, your kids are going to be gone. There's this kind of understanding between him and Alan where, even though he hasn't come out and said, like, I also have kids who have grown up too fast, it's this understanding that that's something that's implied anyway. Did you get that too? That Dan Loria had kids that grew up too fast?
I think he does say he was a kid. He has kids. I may be wrong, but I thought I remembered him saying that. And yeah, this was definitely a man speaking from experience.
The reason why I found that so interesting is because the Wonder Years ends when Kevin graduates high school.
Ah.
So, like, it's kind of like this thing of just like, yeah, we know that you've had kids that have grown up too fast. We saw it like 3 years ago on TV. And so, I don't know. I thought that was kind of, I don't know if that was what they were trying to imply, but having him there and also having all of this home footage of Ben Savage.
Yeah, Ben. See, it's not as easy, is it?
It's not easy. But there's all this home footage of Ben Savage, and in the background, I think I see Fred Savage in there. It felt like a very Fred Savage cameo-ish episode, even though he wasn't there.
Yeah, I think what you're hinting at is something that I didn't realize until you pointed out that he was the father from Wonder Years, but it's kind of like a handing over of the baton.
Or
the gavel, I guess, in this case. As one TV father to another TV father, like, all of this goes by quickly. You know, like, before you know it, all of it's gone. So just really cherish it. And there's more I want to talk about with Judge Lamb, but I really thought that was positive.
Was Feeny in this episode?
Yes, he was. Remember, he has a conversation with Alan about why he never had kids.
Yes, and that's why Alan should be appreciative of his situation, because at least he has kids, is what Feeny's lesson was to him.
What I thought was interesting about that is Feeny specifically says it was a choice not to have kids. So that's, I don't know why, but you don't always get that. Sometimes you hear, you know, about these couples who have been married for a while and they couldn't, or whatever may, like, you know, life went by, they forgot to have kids. But Feeny was like, no, I absolutely chose not to have kids because I couldn't handle the responsibility. And I think that says a lot, because Alan's like, your life is kids. He's like, no, my job is kids.
Job, yeah. You know, how interested would you be in a prequel Feeny show? Like, we've about Feeny, like, being married, him, like, being a teacher in his early years, figuring it out. Like, would you be down for that?
Who would not? But, like, name one person who wouldn't want a Feeny Meets World, like, television show.
Feeny Meets World. Disney Plus, are you hearing us?
I mean, because think about it. Like, especially in the whole idea of Feeny being young at, like, during the 60s and 70s, and watching him grow to learn all of these life lessons he will eventually hand off. I think it's great.
Wow. I don't really have much else to say about this episode. I mean, like I said, there are some conflicts, like, that Alan brings up that I don't feel like are supernatural, but for the most part, not supernatural, like, not super space, natural for his character. But for the most part, like, I do like this episode. Like, when the episode ends, I'm like, you know what, Michael Jacobs, I'm in it. You got me. I still am a fan, despite the fact that I had issues with most of the episode.
Well, I have a problem with Judge Lamb, and I don't have a problem with him per se, but I have a problem with the legal system that we get with Judge Lamb. We kind of hinted on it with the fact that he goes directly to court. They're like, if you can't pay the fine, you have to see someone. the way that he is kind of like mean and overbearing to Corey, but also like toying with him with the balloons, you know, like
the balloon thing, bro, what the hell was that?
Yeah. But again, it's this dynamic of this, it's a power play. And I like that Sean, being who he is, comes, he goes, let me tell you, anyone who will make you a balloon animal in the middle of a case will absolutely send you away. You know what I mean? Like, it's like this guy may seem all cuddly, but I think he's mad serious in abusing the law, if I'm going to be honest. And the for me, the idea of him even talking to Alan, saying that, Corey, you're lucky, you have this family dynamic that is different from all of these other kids that are in front of me, makes me think, who else is in front of Judge Lamb, and does he have the same leniency and understanding as he does with Corey in this case?
Totally. It's so interesting that you interpreted the balloon animals as him being like kind of kooky, because I thought of it as them literally soft pedaling the legal system. Like, in no reality would a black kid be taken to a judge who makes him balloon animals. It just felt like they were whitewashing the legal system and what people actually have to go through when they have really toxic, you know, interactions with police officers who pull them over.
Well, so what I'm actually responding to is the fact that I feel like it's specifically different for Corey. Like, the way that he's talking to Corey makes me feel that if this was a black kid in front of him, it wouldn't be the same. Like, if we take Carlton and Will and put them in front of him instead, and it's Uncle Phil who shows up, I feel like it would have been more of an issue instead of what we get, which is this compassionate, I understand what's going on here, especially when he's like, hey, I want you to take this quarter and call your dad. And Corey's like, no, I don't think so. I don't think I'm wrong. And it's like, you just basically told a judge, I'd rather go to jail than call my father. Yeah. And the judge responded with sympathy instead of what I feel like a judge like Judge Lamb would do, which is really see it as entitlement. And I don't know. Do you get where I'm going with this?
Totally. And I love that you brought up the Carlton and Will thing, because I literally just watched that episode from season one of Fresh Prince where Carlton and Will get pulled over for going too slow under the speed limit. And what happens to them, where they actually have to have Uncle Phil, a lawyer, come and threaten the police station in order to let these guys go, you know, compared to Ben Savage and Corey Matthews, who are also from Philadelphia, having a very different interaction with the police department for going over. Like, they broke the law. Carlton and Will didn't. And yet they both had different experiences. Again, different TV shows, but I think it's also a reflection of what the justice and legal system's like for white kids in the 90s versus black kids in the 90s and even now.
And yeah, that's my thing. I guess for me, I saw hinted at a different version of Judge Lamb if this wasn't Corey. And Sean's commentary of, look, I can tell this who this guy is, and this guy is someone who, if you didn't have the privilege and you didn't have the whiteness behind you, this would probably go very differently.
How do you feel about watching this episode, I don't know, like a month or two after George Floyd? Like, does it change, like, anything watching this episode, knowing that, like, we're having such a national conversation about the way cops treat people when they're pulled over? Or is this more of, like, a relic from the past? Like, there's
no, I think,
just like, wow, this is a time capsule of that moment.
No, I think looking at anything dealing with officers now is a complete and like, I just watched Thelma and Louise for the first time the other day. And halfway through this, I was like, this has to be satire and commentary on the American police system, because there's no way, none of this makes sense, and every reaction is an overreaction. And I feel like now that we are all talking about it and we're all re-examining what they call copaganda and like our legal system in real life versus our legal system on television, I could not watch this episode and not think about the myriad of ways this would be different if this was a person of color.
Yeah.
Same. Okay. All right. So that's pretty much what I have.
Oh, I have one last thing I want to throw in. And this is just a little tidbit. In the flashback, a home video of a young Ben Savage, it includes some footage of him playing with toy wrestlers. I have mentioned in the past that I feel like this show has like a connection with wrestling through the cast or the showrunners being fans of the sport. And I think seeing a young Ben Savage play with toy wrestlers and then knowing how much wrestling plays a part in the show, I can't help but think that he was kind of geeking out at the idea of being able to work with, you know, Jake the Snake or, you know, later in, I think there's, you know, Mankind makes an appearance later in the seasons. There's just wrestling just keeps coming up. And I think that this little flashback footage was really a cool way to see how Ben's been a fan of that sport for a while.
Speaking of fan of sports, it's funny to me because you reminded me when we were talking about things that Alan would do for Corey's birthday. I was like, why not go to a baseball game? Why would that not be the thing that you did for Corey on his 16th birthday? I just
Can I give you a reason? Corey hasn't talked about baseball in like 3 seasons. That's why. Corey don't give a shit about sports.
Apparently, we don't talk about anything anymore, Alan and Corey. So, anyway, that all said, do you have a bruh moment or do you have a Feeny lesson?
I guess, again, the Feeny lesson, really, I didn't really walk away with one other than just to, like, cherish your kids while they're young. I don't really know what Corey's lesson would be there, just to kind of show sympathy to his father that's going to lose his son. I don't really know if that's the main lesson. The bruh moment that I just can't get over is just, again, how a kid was pulled over in the middle of the night, taken immediately into a trial with one judge to, you know, give him a verdict at that moment without a legal guardian or a lawyer present was wild.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say the exact same thing for me. My bruh moment would be that, but my lesson, I think, is the whole, it's a speed trap thing. The idea of taking your time with all of it, you know, it's like everything goes by too quickly and you can get caught up. So just take your time and appreciate it for what it is.
Sure.
Okay. Grade. What grade are you giving this?
I'm giving this a B-. It's okay.
Yeah. Honestly, I think now that you said it, I was going to give it a B and now I think I'll stick at a B. Like, it's a good story. It has a lot of really big highs. There are a few issues, but we use everyone well. And I just think it's a great, memorable episode.
Sure.
All right. That being said, homework. What you got?
You know, I have been watching Blackish on Hulu recently.
Really?
I don't know how much you watch the series, but when I first got introduced to Blackish, it felt like, you know, like people going out of their way to explain Black culture to white people, which was kind of my first reaction. So I didn't really like get into the show at all. But when Juneteenth happened, I had shown my fiance their Juneteenth episode, which is actually incredibly well done. Mm-hmm. And then I saw that they did a video on police brutality, which was also incredibly well done. And so it's made me give the show a second chance. And it's actually not really a bad show. I'm actually liking it quite a bit. I'm liking that this is a show that's tackling the issues that we want shows to tackle, specifically with race issues. The whole thing is about being, you know, the first Black family to kind of, this main character is the first guy to make it out of the hood, and then two, you know, upward mobility and, like, you know, being in the upper middle class or whatever, and just how it feels to have all your kids go to school with white kids. And like, are they losing their culture? And what does that do for you as a Black man when you see that? You know, you wanted them to get out of the hood, yet here they are losing the things that you feel are important. So seeing things like that being tackled on a weekly sitcom that's going out nationally on ABC is kind of cool in a way that I wish I would have appreciated the show more from the beginning. But anyways, I've been watching it. It's on Hulu, and I would recommend it for people who want a little bit more social commentary out of their sitcoms.
Absolutely. I think that when I first watched Blackish, it was very much what you were talking about, explaining Black issues to white audiences. And I think sometimes they still do that, but what they've really learned to do was bring in these writers of color and start telling stories for people of color and for people who are in that demographic of, hey, now that you're here, let's have that conversation that we've all been having of how should I feel about having a family member who was incarcerated, and should I help them? Should I not? You know, like there are all of these dynamics that they
There's a beautiful episode on colorism within the Black community, just things that I don't feel like get talked about very often on national television. I'm exactly. like, I'm here for these conversations happening. So
yeah, so that's a really good one. And thank you for sharing. Yeah. For me, my homework this week is the it's kind of like a book. It's kind of like a short story. I don't know what it really would be called, but it's called The Burnout Generation by Anne Helen Peterson. This hit BuzzFeed like a while ago, but it just talks about being millennials and the generation of basically go-getters. And we like did everything that we could to keep our head above water, and life just keeps knocking at us. and what that does to your mental side. Psychology and the burnout that a lot of people experience from just going hard to like reach this end goal that is ever moving. And I thought it was very helpful. It was really great to examine the different ways that it affects different people, the different demographics, and just there's no solutions really offered because how could you, especially during this time, but it may feel good to be seen. And I thought that was something that could be helpful for everyone. So
that's super interesting. I've been listening, I've been watching all these like think piece Vox videos and reading articles about the psychological impacts of millennials and just what we've gone through from 9/11 through the housing crisis through COVID and, you know, a myriad of Black people getting shot and killed on national television. Just what it means to be our generation and how, you know, the mental effects of, you know, being the generation that has produced more for the country than any other generation, yet is getting less than mm-hmm. any other generation. Mm-hmm. I would be fascinated to look into that because that's something that I've been looking into quite a bit.
Yeah, definitely. Again, it's called The Burnout Generation, and it's basically, it's showing like the different ways that you could get burnout. It's like, do you have like laundry that you just can't bring yourself to fold, or like an inbox where you know that all you need to do is check this email and you just can't.
I'm feeling personally attacked. See, I'm feeling personally attacked as I look at my laundry.
Exactly, but that's what I thought. And considering our demographic, I figured you all would feel seen by it or at least get something from it. So anyway, that is our episode. Do you have anything else you want to say?
Nothing. I want to encourage everyone out there to you know, continue to do what they can to be an ally to Black lives. I know that my social media feeds are starting to look a little normal, and I'm still quite pissed off that Black people keep dying. So I'm sure that there are other people who feel like me, and there are ways that you can get involved. You know, if you go on our Instagram page, especially, we have a link that has, it's a link tree that has all the links to where our podcasts are, but there's also a swipe up where you can, you know, find different ways that you can give to the Black community right now. I'm going to keep preaching this regardless of, you know, how recently someone has died in the news, because Black Lives Matter all the time.
Absolutely. Thank you guys. Make sure to leave us a 5-star ratings. We appreciate, I'm getting a lot of people reach out to us on social media and be like, how can we help or what can we do? And until we actually get like a Patreon or anything set up, right now, just giving us 5 stars on iTunes would be helpful, and continue to listen and share. Leave us a rating. As said, you can find us on all the places, Stitcher, Spotify, Google, we're there. And follow us at Brown Meets World on the social platforms or email us at brownmeetsworld@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter at I Am Not Your Oreo. That is IAMNOTOREO. TC?
Still great fucking name, bro. I'm loving it. I love I'm Not Your Oreo. You can find me on Instagram at abraverme, at .braver.me. And if you guys have any thoughts about this specific episode, about the tension between Alan and Corey, about Corey's interaction with the police, please reach out to us on all of our social media. You can email us. We'd love to get your thoughts on this specific issue, especially considering how much attention is on police right now and their interactions with people, you know, through traffic stops and stuff. Love to get your thoughts on all that.
Yes, thank you guys. That's pretty much it. I guess we will ask you guys to dream
to try
and do good.
Do some damn good, guys. We need it. We all need some good done.
Later, bros.
Later, bruh.